You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park. Around 3 million years ago, a little child, more specifically Australopithecus Africanus child, around 3 years old, was playing in the grass where her family would be scavenging close by. All of a sudden from the sky, a giant eagle swooped down and attacked the little child. The child, not more than 26 pounds, would have been too heavy to carry back to the nest. So the eagle did what ancient eagle predators did. It pecked and pecked at the child, pecked in the eyes and in the skull, hoping to dismember it and carry it back to its nest in pieces. The eagle's plan was interrupted before the body could be taken apart. Unfortunately for the child, it was too late to save her. She was somehow carried back into a cave in what is now known as Makapansgat in South Africa and laid to rest with what is thought to be a prehistoric toy. Now, I'm going to link to this because you have to see this toy and the other works of art we're going to be talking about today. It's critical, so make sure you go and check out this link. But next to this child is a water-worn pebble that was buried, and it resembles a human face. Now, there's some problems with the fact that it's a human face because the human face wouldn't have necessarily resembled an Australopithecus face. But it does have features of both. It's a reddish-brown jasperite rock, and it has two sockets for an eye hole and a mouth and cheekbones. This child and this rock would have existed over 3 million years ago, in 3 million BCE. This child would have laid quietly in the cave for millions of years until in the early 20th century, workers at a limestone quarry in South Africa were digging up fossils. And they'd been doing this in this certain area for a while because they were mining some of the other limestone. They found plant fossils and they found bones of primates, including baboons. And they were just sort of these interesting curios that they would sell to Europeans that happened to manage the operations there. It was in 1924 that workers at the Buxton Lime Works near Tong, South Africa, found a little fossilized primate skull to someone named E.G. Izod. E.G. Izod was a visiting director of the Northern Lime Company and the managing director of the quarry. The director saw the skull, thought it was interesting, and gave it to his son, Pat Izod, who displayed it over the mantle of his fireplace back at home. It wasn't until a very smart, very astute young woman, Josephine Sammons, who happened to be a friend of the Izod family, paid a visit to Pat's home, and she noticed the primate skull. She correctly identified it as an extinct monkey and realized its possible significance and what it could mean. She happened to be friends with someone named Raymond Dart. Now, Raymond Dart was an anatomist at the University of Witwatersrand, and Josephine was the first female student of Raymond Dart. She asked if she could take the skull and present it to her mentor, Raymond Dart, and he also recognized the significance of the find, and he actually took credit for the find. Dart asked the company to send any more interesting fossilized skulls that should be unearthed. That's when they, you know, visited the quarry, and they found a collection of fossilized primate skulls that had been gathered from the mine. Now, through a series of testing and finding more samples and more fossils, they named these fossils the Taung Child, T-A-U-N-G. This idea of this child being killed by an eagle was controversial, but as evolutionary biologist Susan Schultz of the University of Liverpool in England says, they have collected prey from eagles' nests in the Thai rainforest in the southwestern part of France. The discarded remains in these nests include bones and skulls of mangabeys, large, predominantly ground-living monkeys. So the latest research is showing us that prehistoric raptors would have been quite capable of successfully attacking a young Australopithecus africanus. The Taung cave specimen weighed around 26 pounds at the time of death. Schultz would say, quote, When the Tong baby was discovered, there were several people who proposed that an eagle had perhaps killed it. One of the big criticisms of that was that the Tong baby would have been way too heavy to be picked up by an eagle. That's totally misunderstanding the behavior of these eagles. African crowned eagles have been known to occasionally attack or eat human children. There's one report from South Africa of a small child's skull being found in a nest, end quote. So this is a skull from over 3 million years old. And what's fascinating to me about this is that there's a possible toy or relic as old as 3 million years ago that early humans, maybe that was an incorrect word, early forms of humans would have been using over 3 million years ago. Let that sink in. What would life have been like that long ago? Well, certainly the Australopithecus africanus would have resembled more of a monkey than it would of a human. They usually walked on two legs. Limb, hand, and foot bones indicate that they were also adept at climbing. Most likely, they would have been mainly vegetarian, and they were not active hunters. Again, more resembled to apes than to humans. And there's not really evidence to suggest that they had the ability at this point to make tools or fire. But there's a possibility of this rock being buried next to this child, which means something interesting, that these early forms of humans got together and buried a child in a cave and left a relic with it. That's fascinating. Human culture really evolves as human beings evolve. And the next few episodes in the podcast are going to talk about some of the earliest women in history that we know about and the culture that comes along with it. Now, one of the earliest women that we know about, her name is Ardi. And Ardi is the oldest known hominid skeleton, living in Ethiopia around 4.4 million years ago. It was really hard to piece together her partial remains. There's about 125 separate pieces, including her skull and teeth. She would have been about 4 feet tall and weighed about 110 pounds, and she walked upright. She had a small brain, and her arms and fingers were very long, and her opposable big toe helped her hold onto branches as she moved through the trees. We know from her intact teeth that she would have eaten a lot of plants, fruits, and small mammals. Ardi wasn't a human, and she wasn't a chimpanzee, but she had characteristics of both. Since Ardi's skeleton suggests that humans and chimps evolved separately from a common ancestor, she is important because she effectively disproves this theory that human beings might have evolved from early chimps. Instead, we now know that humans have been evolving separately from apes for at least the last 6 million years. Scientists are still trying to unravel this mystery and figure out where humans and chimps split from their common ancestor. You can go visit Ardi's remains in the National Museum of Ethiopia. Now, another one that you've probably all heard of, and one of the earliest women, they have named her Lucy. Lucy was discovered in Ethiopia in 1974, and she's probably the most famous fossil discovered of all time. And for good reason, because Lucy's remains revolutionized how we think about human evolution. Before her discovery, scientists and anthropologists believed that intelligence from humans predated our ability to walk on two legs. But Lucy proved that the opposite was true. Lucy would have shown up somewhere between 3.2 million years ago and was the oldest known human skeleton until Ardi was found. And it's said there's some lore around her name being Lucy, but it was said that the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was playing on the radio when the first of her 47 bones were discovered. And so they liked the name and they decided to stick. Scientists know that Lucy was a female because of other discoveries that show that the males of her species were much larger. She happened to be smaller. They also know that she was a fully grown adult, probably about 21 years old. And they know a lot of this from her human-like wisdom teeth that were exposed prior to her death. She's also kept in the National Museum of Ethiopia. Now, there's another woman we're going to talk about, but woman I'm going to use in quotations because very little is known. This early specimen is dubbed X-Woman, like something out of a Marvel comic book. And she lived in Siberia around 40,000 years ago. So we have Artie, then we have Lucy, and then one of the earliest women is X-Woman. Now, they only found a pinky finger. So because it was smaller, they believed it belonged to a woman, but now they're beginning to believe it belonged to a child. Still, X-Woman's discovery is important because this was the new type of human that had been discovered through DNA testing. Previously, before finding X-Woman, science had no idea about the prehistoric human or the wave of migration out of Africa that X-Woman's little pinky finger implies. Scientists at the time did know that Homo erectus left Africa around 2 million years ago, but they didn't really know what happened for the next 1.5 million years after that. Since X-Woman's ancestors probably left Africa around 1 million years ago, she confirms that there was a migration continuing during this time. Something interesting about her DNA is that it's DNA taken from Neanderthals or modern humans, indicating the possible existence of a third species. Scientists don't really know a lot about how all these species, Neanderthals and humans, and this third species, the H. Denisovans, have to do with each other or how they came in contact with each other. But we do know that humans interbred with the Denisovans at some point, since Australian Aborigines and the Melanesians of New Guinea share around 5% of the DNA with the X-Woman. It's fascinating to think about. Now, before we get into the last woman we're going to talk about on this series, I want to talk about some of the art we found. We talk about this little water-worn pebble found next to the Tong Child. Now, I'm going to bring on Professor Nancy Ross, an art historian, who is going to talk about some of the early Paleolithic art that was found that has to do with women. And I want you to think about this because we're talking about human beings making art thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. Maybe it just blows my mind because I grew up in a Mormon home and a Christian home believing that the world was possibly only 7,000 years old. So when I hear about art that's 40,000 years old, it blows my mind. So I'll let Dr. Nancy Ross take us in.
I'm Nancy Ross. I have a PhD in art history from the University of Cambridge, and I'm an assistant professor at Dixie State University teaching art history. And the first piece we're going to look at is the nude woman from Willendorf, sometimes called the Venus of Willendorf, but that's not really an appropriate name today. So I'm going to go with nude woman. She was found, discovered in a riverbed or in a riverbank in Willendorf, Austria, about 100 years ago. And she was made by nomadic peoples between 28,000 and 25,000 BCE. She's made of limestone, and unusually, she's only 4 1/4 inches high. You can hold her in your hand. And today she resides in the Natural History Museum in Vienna. So I used to teach this figure every year, but she was a little tricky to start the class with. So we kind of removed Paleolithic art. One of the things that's really important when we're looking at Paleolithic art is to realize that while today we can read the letters of Van Gogh or we can know what Leonardo wrote in his notebooks, with Paleolithic artists, we have no idea what they were thinking or feeling or why they created the art that they did. All we have are these artifacts. Writing was invented in about 3500 BCE. And so this figure, the nude woman, predates writing by millennia. And so we don't know a lot about their culture other than to know that people were nomadic. Farming was invented at about 10,000 BCE. So this is many millennia before the invention of farming. She's handheld in size. You can imagine that people would carry her around. She can't stand on her own 2 feet. So she's not a statue as we think of statues today, standing upright. She would have been held. One of the things that I think is the most interesting about this figurine is that so she's made of limestone. The artist who carved her probably was a pretty sophisticated, practiced artist. And that may not be, if you're not very familiar with art, that may not be immediately apparent, but that is something that is apparent to me as an art historian. She has these very exaggerated features. She has extremely large breasts. You can see her tiny little hands. kind of cupping over the top of her breasts. She has a very large stomach, very large buttocks, very large thighs. And so all of her kind of female parts are strongly emphasized, as well as her pubic triangle. And she doesn't even get proper feet at the bottom of her. It's just kind of these lady parts that are emphasized. She also doesn't have eyes and or a well-defined face. And it's unclear, again, to why this woman has these exaggerated features. One of the things that I think is most interesting is that this limestone figure is covered in red ochre. Red ochre is a red chalk. And so whoever made her felt that the red was significant enough to kind of cover this figure in red. And so she's a very famous figurine from the Paleolithic period. But there are other figurines that exist from the Paleolithic period as well. Many of them are women. And so when we're talking about Paleolithic art, we are often talking about representations of women. These representations of women are often similar to what we see here with the Venus of Willendorf. They're often women with very exaggerated breasts and hips and thighs and pubic triangle. And so a lot of things have been suggested as to what she means. It's been suggested that she is, in fact, a Venus that was part of her earliest identification, as though she was some kind of forerunner to the Greek goddess Aphrodite or Venus. But we can't look backwards in that way. And because if the Greek culture was much, much, much later than she was made, and we don't have any writings about her, because writing wasn't invented until long after she was made. And so a lot of anthropologists or archaeologists or art historians have tried to suggest what she might be. But I'm just going to say that we don't know who she is. We don't know if she represents kind of a Mother Earth figure, or if she represents a Venus type figure, or if she's meant to represent a goddess of sorts, or if she represents an aspiration, like, you know, nomadic people would have followed their food around through the seasons. And does she represent a very healthy, overfed woman, which would have been very rare in the Paleolithic period? Does she represent a pregnant woman? You know, a pregnant woman, we don't have the answers to any of these particular questions. And I think that it's okay that we don't have those answers. I think we need to be comfortable with that, as opposed to assigning her an identity that is inappropriate given that we know so little about her context. But I think that she draws quite a lot of questions, and she is the earliest of these Paleolithic female figurines that have been found. And where she was found in Vienna, the limestone wouldn't have been mined. My understanding is the limestone wouldn't have been mined in Willendorf, Austria, because there isn't limestone there. And so, again, representative of the fact that somebody would have made her and mined that limestone in another place and then brought her to Willendorf, Austria. Okay, another figurine that we're going to be looking at is the woman holding a bison horn from La Salle, France, made in the period from perhaps 25,000 BCE to perhaps 20,000 BCE. Again, this is made of limestone, painted limestone, and it's about 1.5 feet tall, and it's at a museum in Bordeaux. It is one of the earliest known relief sculptures. And like the nude woman that we looked at previously, she has very exaggerated breasts, very exaggerated hips, very exaggerated pubic triangle. We don't get the details of her face. But instead of cupping her arms around her body, she holds this bison horn. And again, the temptation is for us to identify her. And I think that trying to identify her is inappropriate, because we just don't have the appropriate context. And so we need to try and refrain from doing that. One of the things that I think is really interesting, which also links her to the nude woman we looked at before, which is that her body is also covered in this same red ochre. And this red ochre is a common feature of nude female figurines from the Paleolithic period, whether they are consciously linked. And the red is a kind of element of iconography or not is unclear, again, because we don't have context. But I think that that is an interesting element. People have suggested that the red ochre represents the blood of childbirth or menstrual blood, and that somehow these nude figurines were associated with or possibly used as talismans. But again, that's unclear.
Okay, so can you tell us, the pubic triangle comes up a lot in Paleolithic art. Can you give us some more context for that?
I think that pubic triangle, I mean, first of all, these are nude figures. So, and all these sexual characteristics are emphasize. And so I think that the emphasis of the pubic triangle, you know, fits in very nicely with all of that. It's, you might suggest that sex and sexuality or sensuality was important to these people. It might be that childbirth was important to these people. It might be something else. But I think together with the red ochre and the possible suggestion of blood, there is a sense of perhaps women as kind of this life-giving force. And again, that's very much in the realm of suggestion and not in the realm of conclusion.
We're going to bring Dr. Nancy Ross to talk about all kinds of women in history and all of this art, so look forward to more from her. But she illustrates some important things, that human beings were interested in the female form, interested in the body, and they used the female form for some sort of significant purpose. What, we can only guess. But as we find more and more discoveries, we'll be able to draw more and more conclusions. It's really exciting. This story is going to be something really fascinating because this talks about gender bias in the field and has to do with an amazing story. Now, I had originally published this as The Red Lady of Pavilion, talking about the Red Lady as a female. When someone pointed it out, actually the bones have been identified as male. And this is really important because this shows sort of the biases that we have and how they affect our discoveries. You see, when these bones were found, they were identified as female. Thus, we get the name the Red Lady of Pavilion. When she was discovered by William Buckland, who was a professor of geology at Oxford University. And because of the way it was laid out, he thought maybe it was a burial of a prostitute because of the ochre on the body, and he assigned it to a woman. So because of the jewelry and because of the ochre, he assumed it was a woman. And it wasn't until later that others examined the bones and actually assigned it to a young man, a healthy adult male, about 25 to 30 years old, with the red ochre being found on the body. This is where the term the Red Lady comes from. He was found in the El Marón cave. He lived somewhere about 18,700 years ago, just towards the end of the last ice age. He was dubbed the Red Lady because the bones were covered in this reddish pigment called red ochre. And scientists took the bones because they were fascinated with the red ochre and did a chemical analysis. It revealed something fascinating, that this red ochre that had covered the body did not come from a local source, meaning that it was either the result of some long-distance trade or some significant travel. The pigment was hard to get, at least where it was found. It might have been part of a ritual, or it might have been used as a preservative. Either way, someone went to a lot of effort to cover the bones in this red ochre. When he died, would have been about 35 to 40 years old, but researchers can't exactly figure out the cause of death. He seemed to be in great health when he died. He had a good diet of ibex, red deer, fish, mushrooms, fungi, and seeds. And so, by all accounts, he seemed healthy. The body was buried in this small little space at the back of this cave. Strangely enough, it was buried after it decomposed. Researchers know this because the bones are covered in this black manganese oxide, which forms as bodies decay above ground. So the body decayed above ground, exposed, and then somehow he was given an elaborate burial. What does it all mean? That elaborate burial, including etchings found near the grave, suggest that he was somehow important and somehow special. Again, you know, almost 20,000 years ago, when you don't have a lot of resources and you don't have a lot of calories to waste, this effort being put into a body means something. But we don't know exactly what. When he was living, he and his peers would have used stone tools. They would have used needles made from bones, and they would have made projectile weapons fashioned from antlers of deer. The cave would most likely have been used for shelter and living quarters. His family would have hunted for ibex and red deer. They would have fished for salmon. They would have eaten plants, and they would have scavenged for seeds and mushrooms. Now, this red ochre, which we now know comes from hematite crystal, has now faded from his body. The hematite comes from the Greek word for blood and is often used as a pigment, particularly in cave paintings. And as Dr. Ross suggested, there is this implication that because of the color, that it is somehow related to humans' connections with blood. No one knows for sure if there were clothes or his body were covered with this pigment when he died, but people think that the bones were covered ritually with this. And we know this from other practices. So like in the Mayan culture, for example, bodies were covered in a similar way, and they used blue pigment to signify that they were a sacrifice to the gods. But since Red Lady was in living quarters when buried, suggests somehow that he was a person of status or authority and had to be buried in a way to oversee his subjects. They didn't want to let him go. He was possibly an offering to the gods, but maybe something as a reminder to the people who stayed there. His status is also thought to be elite because of the presence of a primitive tombstone. This is fascinating, but during the excavation, a large rock was found that had reportedly fell from the ceiling, and it had been engraved with straight lines across it. Among these engravings, the researchers found a V-shaped motif that they think suggests the representation of the pubic triangle, which Dr. Ross was talking about. This further complicates this whole idea of the Red Lady of Pavilion being a male versus female, because depending on how the pubic triangle is shaped, if it's tipping down, it's said to be female, and if it's tipping up, it's said to be male. It adds to this whole confusion, which is, I think is fascinating, that when all is said and done, when you're left to bones, and you're left there a long time, it's really hard to tell if you are a man or a woman, and that should tell us something about ourselves. As far as the rest of the cave, the eastern face of the block was intensely stained with this red ochre, near where the bones were found, creating a link between the block and the body. The corpse was seemingly laid to rest on his left side, with the back towards the block, covered with the red ochre, the chest facing towards the cave wall. The head was at the northern end of the burial, and the corpse was most likely tightly flexed in a fetal position. Something else interesting about this is that at some point, a carnivore, probably a domesticated dog or a wolf, crept into the cave, dug in and found the body, and gnawed at the shin bone, the tibia, and took it away. But the bone was later reburied with the body and recovered with this red ochre. The skeleton, while remarkable, is still missing a few things, like the skull. And they were likely removed by either the carnivore who was chewing on the bones, or by humans who may have wanted to display them. After the death, we see the rise of the Magdalenian people, who become synonymous with resettling northwestern Europe after the last glacial maximum. The Magdalenians would have been hunter-gatherers, and they would have traveled all around in sort of herds, following herds and where the food would have been. But the Magdalenian people were famous for manipulating skeletons, so it's possible that they found Red Lady's remains and took them because they had some sort of significance. But if they did take the pieces of the bone, they left the others to stay right in their place. So it's just a theory, and the most likely theory is a carnivore often took one of the bones to chew on it. This is only one small example of the thousands and thousands and thousands of early people roaming the earth. And all we have left are these skeletons, these bones shrouded in this beautiful mystery, this red ochre, this cave, these interesting symbols. What do they mean, and who was this person? This is where human beings come from. These cultures that are so far distant from us, we can only dream and imagine who they are. In the next episode, we're going to talk about some other early forms of human beings that have been found, who they are, what they could possibly mean, and maybe give us something to think about as we go around our day in the modern world, thinking that we understand the place that we live in and who we are and where we come from. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Story of Woman podcast. The Story of Woman podcast is produced by Lindsay Hanson Park, co-produced by Jake Spurlock of Wired Magazine, Grace Poole, and Adam Groves. We are generously sponsored by Bluehost and Bluehost.com. Bluehost is one of the largest and most trusted web hosting services, powering millions of websites. you go and get on Bluehost right now, you can get a free domain name. The web art is designed by Geralyn Hasselpoole, with the music provided generously by Lady Murasaki. Check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you heard today, consider a donation at storywoman.org.